Blog Talk Radio.
You are tuned in to Paranormal Horizons with your hosts, Jason Ophir and Sherry Pang. Stay tuned as we enter the world of the unknown. There is a silent, invisible world that surrounds us all. A world we don't understand. A world that we wish to understand. And on Paranormal Horizons, we're going to explore this and hopefully get some answers. Good evening, everyone. I'm Jason Ophir, as always. Welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons. I'm here with Maria Wilson Duff. Maria, how's it going?
It's going great tonight. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. I was telling you before the show, I'm freezing. I'm all bundled up doing the show.
So what's the temperature there outside?
Yes, it's probably 50 degrees, but I'm a subterranean dweller. I was telling you I live in a basement, and that's super fantastic during the summer. So when it's like 101 out, I'm just loving life. But during the winter, you know, it gets kind of cold.
No, see, we're just totally opposite. Of course, I have a cattle farm, so I kind of have to be outside. It's the nighttime. I want it dark and I want it cold.
I wish I lived out in the country. I love stargazing, and I never get to do it because I live in the heart of Portland, Oregon, the city, so I never get to see the stars. Are you out in the country out there?
I am. I don't have any light pollution at all around me.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Do you ever see anything weird in the skies out there?
I have. But I don't start yelling UFO until, it lands in my backyard.
Little green aliens start coming out.
Yeah. Whenever I see them start running around my backyard, then I'll kind of know. But, between all the military helicopters that fly around back and forth, because I kind of live in an area between Fort Knox and Fort Campbell, and there's a few other little military areas. I don't know if they're just flying back and forth or if they're actually looking for something, and I kind of sometimes don't want to know. It's safer that way.
I can only imagine what the military does that we don't know about, you know, stuff that they were doing 50, 60 years ago that's been declassified, just heinous stuff to the American people and all sorts of crazy things. Who knows what they're doing nowadays? It's kind of scary not knowing, but I guess ignorance could be considered bliss in a lot of cases.
Yes. In most cases it is, because the less you know, the better off you are.
Yeah. Well, we got a great returning guest tonight. We have Brian Hewlett, and he's an exorcist, so it looks like he's in queue, so we're going to bring him on right now and maybe talk some demons.
Wonderful.
Brian, you there?
Yes. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. Hey, you know, I feel like I'm butchering your last name. Can you say it for me? Because I'm like hooked on phonics. I cannot pronounce even basic words.
You're not alone with this one. I've heard just about every possible derivative of pronunciation. So believe me, I kind of respond to them all by now. But the correct pronunciation is Willette.
Willette.
Like a W.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Think of Ouija board.
There you go. Okay,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So how have you
the
been?
The French have this little weird thing, you know, when you put two vowels together, or an OU rather, before a vowel, you get a W sound. Go figure.
Oui.
Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
It is. It's French. Yes. Ta-da.
It's French,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay because my name is Maria, and that gets butchered all the time. Go figure. I mean, that's pretty simple.
That's a little surprising. That's actually surprising. But in today's world, you know, maybe not.
How do people butcher Maria? That's pretty easy.
Thanks. It is pretty easy. I've been called Marcia, Marcy, and, of course, Marie a lot. They tend to get the A at the end. But, yeah, I mean, you'd think it'd be pretty simple, but apparently it's not.
What can you do?
I know. Well, Brian, for the benefit of the listeners, can you kind of give our listeners a reminder of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, I am the presiding bishop of the autocephalous Holy Nicolaitan Catholic Church, which is in communion with the Old Catholic Church through the Old Catholic Order of Exorcists, which was established under Ron File back in the late 70s, early 80s. And I work in collaboration with the order for the Atlanta division, Atlanta, Georgia, where we investigate the claims of demonic activity and help those that have genuine problems resolve them. So you might, some of your audience members might have seen me on the hit Travel Channel show Ghost Adventures. I've been on that, I think, 5 times now. And, you know, you can get to see some of my work there. But I, you know, I've been doing this for quite a while now. And it's an interesting work. You see some very bizarre things. And, you know, if you go into it with a skeptical mind, if you really seriously commit to the work, and you have any bit of skepticism within you, that quickly fades away, I find, after you've done the work for a while. Because then you start to see the difference between, you know, what would be a standard mental disorder or some kind of psychosis and a genuine demonic event. They you know, there is variation there, even though the effects sometimes in the beginning can look almost identical. And for intents and purposes, they are the same. It's really the causations that are different. But that's what I do.
And I know we're probably going to be asking a lot of the same questions we have on previous shows, but for the benefit of the listeners that may have not listened to the previous shows, so if I'm repeating myself with questions I've asked you before,
bear with me.
No,
that's fine. Sure.
So now, I would imagine doing that, and we've talked before, and that whole subject makes me nervous, you know, anything having to do with demonic. I'd imagine when you're doing exorcisms, when you're doing those sort of things, you're putting yourself at, you've got to be putting yourself at not only physical harm, but spiritual harm as well. Is that correct?
There is risk, yeah. I'd be lying if I said there was no risk at all. We can minimize that risk. And certainly that's part of the reason why I've, over the years, made adjustments to our protocols. In the beginning, I was very relaxed about how we would go about doing this. I would take lay people as well as clergy in and train them. But over time, I realized that the wisdom of the more ancient ways that came out of Roman Catholic and Orthodox systems, it really is something that best belongs to in the hands of the clergy, for safety reasons more than anything else. Not that laity can't handle these things, but there are certain graces that come with the Catholic priesthood that really protect you, almost as an automatic type of thing. There's very little that is required in order to enhance this natural protection that comes from the natural grace of the sacrament of holy orders. And, we can minimize what risks we have to deal with out there. But overall, you're going to get attacked no matter who you are, bishop or layperson. If you're doing this work, if you're coming into regular contact, actually, with demonic forces, you're going to have some consequences. So, you know, part of the training that I do when I, you know, work with new people or, you know, bring people into this outreach ministry as I try to get them to understand the importance of a solid spirituality. In the Catholic faith, you know, that means participation in the sacraments. Coming to Mass on a regular basis as often as possible, receiving the Eucharist, going to confession. I mean, these seem like, you know, maybe cliches to some people because they're really not familiar with this as much as they used to in days past. But there is really nothing more powerful to protect one against these types of attacks. And so overall, when we go into a very severe situation, the worst that tends to happen is maybe a headache. Definitely burning eyes is something that happens frequently. It's very unusual. But there will be a almost like as if somebody threw acid or something into your eyes. It burns. That's a very common attack. And I've seen others get it as well as myself all at the same time. You know, sometimes there will be residual effects where there will be things that happen in your environment. I know that one time I brought a allegedly cursed object into my home, but I had ritually sealed it in the garage until I had the means to deal with it. But at some point, the seal got broken, and there was actually an entity attached to it. And it got out. It ended up shattering my windshield to my car. It broke the windshield to my wife's car. It killed my cat. It wrecked havoc. It even opened up the garage door by itself and set the alarm off when we weren't home. And we even saw manifestations of it, actual apparitions of it. And eventually I reached, when it killed the cat, that was the last straw. And rather than trying to deal with it the way that I normally would, I just opted to destroy it, which I did. And we caught a magnificent photograph. My wife did. When we were the only ones that were there at the time that I had put it into an eradication fire. We call it a holy fire, but it's where we eradicate cursed objects. This was a gohazan, by the way. It was a Buddhist gohazan. And we captured in a face burning. And the reason my wife took the picture is because in person you could actually see what manifested in the flames as a body. And you could see almost as though there were it was flesh burning off of bones. And she tried to capture it on camera. Unfortunately, it didn't. That effect, for whatever reason, did not come through on the camera. But we did capture a face, a burning face, a skeletal shape. It was a remarkable capture, and much more remarkable in actual life than what we were able to get on the camera. But that's just one example of the kinds of risks and dangers and things that you do. So now I have a containment cabinet that I keep at the church offices. I don't bring these things into my house anymore because you just never know if you get lazy or you just don't have the time. Like most of the time, laziness is not my problem. It's just having too much booked. You know, you're not able to keep tabs on all of this stuff. And somehow the seal got broken and that thing got out.
What's your take on, Maria, you're involved in the paranormal. Have you encountered anything dark like that? What's your take on the whole demon thing?
When he said something about killing the cat, I mean, it's just people don't realize how strong. I mean, a lot of times when you deal with clients and going and investigating, you're dealing with something simple. You're not dealing with something that is so powerful that it breaks windshields and kills things. I mean, it, think about it, though. If it can kill a cat, it can kill a human. It's pretty scary. And no, I've not ran into anything like that. And if I did, I mean, the first place I would go to is to go find a priest, because, I mean, who better else to take care of that problem?
Yeah. One of the concerns that I have is, ever since these ghost shows, ghost adventures, all these ghost hunters all came out, it's like everybody out there, you know, you suddenly have an influx of people claiming to be paranormal investigators. And I ran into this, and I've mentioned this a couple times over the years over this show. I had gotten into paranormal investigating, and I had done quite a few. And I was contacted by this person, and he needed help with this investigation. It was a private residence. And what I was quickly able to ascertain was the reason he wanted us there, because he had absolutely no equipment. When we were at these people's house, I asked him a basic question. Like, it was something to the effect of, like, what is an EVP or something like that. And he didn't know, and he referred the person to me. Well, come to find out, this person is now claiming to be a demonologist. And so I think, and from what I'm seeing, is people are just seeing the shows and suddenly they're experts in these fields, not knowing, you know, what they're doing at all. You know, and that's got to be concerning and risky.
Yeah, I'm not a great fan of that phenomenon. And certainly, yes, that is the drawback to these shows. I mean, it's also, fortunately, though, had a positive effect. And part of the positive aspect of this is that it is now showing the secular world that this stuff is real. And I know that there's going to be those that think that because it's reality television, it's faked. And there's no matter what you say and no matter what you do, you're never going to be able to change minds like, you know, that have already made up about that type of thing. So, you know, that we deal with that too. And they think some people have even accused me of being an actor. It's kind of laughable, really. But, you know, that's just how strong some people's objection is to believing in this stuff. But for those that, you know, are willing to have an open mind and see what these shows present, it has made people aware, particularly the shows that I've been involved with where people see the demonic, because I think it is extremely important that people realize the demonic is real, that everybody is at risk, no matter how devout you are or, I guess, how secular you are, regardless of how you live your life. If you're a prolific sinner or you just, you know, you pray every day, everybody's at risk. Doesn't matter. And so, you know, these shows have helped to kind of show that this is a risk. And it also shows that there are people like myself who can help if you, you know, if you need that kind of help, that that help does exist and that it's effective help. It's not just, you know, loosey goosey new age stuff. It's a very ancient formula that is designed to effectuate a resolution for people that come under demonic influence. So, you know, that part's good. But yes, just like you said, the downside is that it's created almost too much interest, and everybody and their mother now wants to be a paranormal investigator, going out there, exploring things. You know, certainly the first time I ever saw or heard the word EVP or electronic voice phenomenon was an old show. Gosh, what was it called? It's escaping me. It was an old show that was on the air back in the early 90s. And it was a really good show. It always had it would feature for an hour different stories about the paranormal, kind of like Unsolved Mysteries, but this focused almost exclusively on paranormal things. Maybe it'll come to me. But I saw that show, and I immediately became fascinated. And so this was before the advent of digital recording, so I went out and bought a brand new microcassette tape that had never been used before and put it into my microcassette recorder. And I just started asking questions in my house by myself, trying to see if anything would talk back. And remarkably, it did. I did get responses to questions, and it really sort of blew my paradigm because, again, I was sort of, I guess, under the impression that, you know, this is television. You can only take so much of this stuff seriously. And, you know, and I was remarkably surprised by just how quickly I was able to get results using this very simple methodology of using a, putting in a brand new tape and just turning it on and asking questions and listening in the background noise for an answer. It even called out my name. There was one time where I just left it recording and I just said something to the effect of, if you're here, please talk to me. And then I left the house and I left it recording. And then about, you can hear me leave the house. And about maybe 10 minutes later, you can hear it call out my name. And I replicated this very same thing again many years later with my wife. And we did it again. We just, you know, if anybody's here, say something. We're going to leave now. And we left. And, you know, about 5-10 minutes into the recording, you can hear a voice call out for my wife. And so anybody can do this. It doesn't require, like, tremendous skill to get into paranormal investigation. It doesn't even require a remarkably large budget. I mean, if you want to buy some of the higher end things, like, you know, full spectrum cameras or, you know, thermal cameras or, you know, SLS, these can be expensive, but, you know, just the basic gear probably pick up for about $200 or $300. So it's very accessible to people and it's fascinating, and everybody wants to know that deepest, darkest of secrets, what lies beyond the grave. You know, because it's sort of the ultimate mystery. We all know we're going to end up there, but almost nobody knows anything about what that is. There's a lot of speculation. Different religions say different things about it, and people want to know. And they want to know if it's actually real, particularly in our day and age when we are moving more towards secular thinking and getting kind of away from religion and spirituality. You know, these questions have sort of created a resurgence in spirituality. So in a lot of ways, these shows have been good as much as they have been not so good. But I do caution anybody, you know, don't just jump into paranormal investigation because you're interested in it. There's real risk there. And just like Maria said, 9 out of 10 times, in fact, probably more than that, more like probably 90 out of 100 times, you're not going to run into anything demonic. It's going to be very low-level paranormal activity, usually residual energy from something that might have occurred on the property or something that might have gotten attached to a family member or something in the household for a while, maybe a recently deceased member. You know, that energy stays around for a while sometimes. So that's usually quite benign. As long as nobody tries to do too much with it, eventually it will dissipate on its own. But the demonic is a whole different ball game. And in the beginning, to the layperson, it looks the same as a ghost. So, you know, you're really not knowing. The average person's not going to be able to tell what's a demon and what's something that's benign.
That's correct. I want to ask you, of course, hundreds of years ago, it seems like everybody was more spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a good way to say it or not, because at that point in time, if you did something wrong, they thought that you were possessed by a demon. But mm-hmm. It seems like, and I want your opinion of when and where you think, from being completely religious as a whole to now, you've got people that don't believe in God, they don't believe in heaven, I mean, they're just agnostic. They don't believe in anything. They just believe we're
right
here and then this is it. Where do you think that turn in that thinking started?
Well, I think it's been a slow progression ever since the Enlightenment, honestly. Ever since the church was put in its place and was slowly deprived of its temporal power, which is actually not a bad thing. It, you know, I don't believe in theocracies. So I think, you know, anytime you have a religion that's in political control of a region, you're looking for a recipe for disaster. Case in point is you know, some of these Muslim countries that are run like theocracies. It's not good. It's not good for the people. It's not good for the world. And it lends itself towards extremism. So, you know, a secular government is a healthy government. The problem, though, is that what transpired out of this is it gave people new freedom to sort of have an excuse not to focus so much on religion. And with an interest in science and science now being able to every year come out with a new development that can answer a question that used to be more so left to the realm of philosophy or religion, even further reinforces the idea that maybe we don't need religion anymore. And then when you have things like holy wars and you have terrorists acting in what they claim to be God's name, it starts to create this aura where maybe we're just better off without it, because does religion do anything good? Then you have the scandals that come. So now we have, like, you know, pedophile priesthood archetype, you know, running rampant and bishops covering it up. And that drives people off even further because they have this, I would say, a very unrealistic expectation for what the church is. People tend to think the church is like this holy place, this place where it's impervious to sin. And honestly, if they really read the scriptures, they'd realize that the whole reason the church exists is because we are sinners and we need constant help. So the church is really going to be a place where there's a lot of iniquity, because that's where the healing needs to start. You know, Jesus says, "I didn't come to, you know, for the righteous. I came for sinners." And there's a lot of truth to that within the whole framework of the church that he leaves us. That doesn't, it's not an excuse for bad behavior, but it does help, hopefully give us a better perspective as to what the church should be. But because we have these misconceptions and then we get hurt because the church isn't able to live up to these expectations, the clergy is not able to live up to those expectations, it drives people away. And then they start to get into this mindset, well, I don't need this anymore. And then now they have the political freedom to say that. There's no repercussions for not, no actual legal repercussions for not supporting one's church or maintaining one's own spirituality. And so that tends to create new waves of thinking. And then it gets reinforced with future generations. So, you know, it's like every generation prior was more actively involved in the church, but they don't seem to be very good about passing it on. You know, the baby boomers, their parents, you know, were almost all, you know, it would be very typical to be going to some church, whatever your particular denomination is. And they more or less reinforced it with the baby boomer generation. But the baby boomers didn't. I know this from firsthand experience. You know, my mom and dad went to Catholic schools. They went to Catholic churches, but they even had me baptized as a baby at the right time, but we never went to church. Never. Occasionally, I think my mother would sometimes get this urge around Christmas to, I guess she was feeling more spiritual or something and wanted to go, but they didn't. And I hated going to church. I mean, the time when we would go visit extended family who were churchgoers, and we would have to go with them because they thought we were churchgoers, and my parents didn't want anyone to know that we didn't. you know, that was that was a miserable experience. I hated it. And, you know, I felt very out of place. I didn't understand it because it wasn't part of my culture. And if it weren't for, you know, being smacked upside the head by God as a teenager, I probably would have never found my vocation. But that's exactly what happened. But that doesn't happen to everybody. And so I think all of these factors are in these little tiny things come together to create a big problem. And now we're a very secular minded society. We don't want anybody telling us how to live our lives. America, Western civilization, but a lot in America too, is very individualistic. And so, you know, the whole idea that something could control you, or you would let somebody or ideology control you, so is very contrary to contemporary thought today. It's part of the whole postmodern, I think, vision that now is part of our lives. So now, by the time you get down to millennials, I'm not sure they even know what a Bible is anymore, you know, because none of that has been passed on.
You're right. There's a lot of people that don't go to church anymore. And I've noticed that a lot of got older, they did not, and they don't pass it down to their kids, but they, for some reason, I guess by osmosis, they think that their children know about God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit and everything about it. And I have recently witnessed a parent who was shocked that their child didn't know what a rainbow stood for, what that symbolism was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand. I really don't understand the phenomenon. I don't. I mean, it's even not even with religion, but it even occurred with other things. Like, for example, my grandfather immigrated here from Sicily. So he obviously grew up fluently Italian, had to learn English as a second language, had a very strong accent. But, you know, Italian was his first language. He married a Polish girl, my grandmother, who immigrated to Canada I think she was actually born in Canada, but she immigrated from Canada here. Her mother was from Poland, immigrated to Canada, then immigrated to the United States. And then on my father's side, both grandparents, came from France. One was born in Canada, the other one, born in France, both moved to Canada, then immigrated to the United States. So I had access in all corners of my family to being able to speak Italian, Polish, and French. Not one of them even bothered to pass it on. My dad speaks fluent French because that was his first language. He did not pass that on to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's shocking.
That's a shame.
You don't see that. It is insane. But see, you don't see that in Hispanic cultures. And guess what? They're also very religious people too. And
yes,
so
they are.
It's a cultural mindset that for whatever reason their own the old culture is not being passed on correctly. But yet you see it in Hispanic cultures where they pass on the family legacy, they pass on the language, and they continue to teach their kids the religion. So, Catholic Church is alive and well in South America, but it's almost dead in Europe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It seems like the morals of society are going downhill. At least that's what I'm saying. I don't know. I could be completely wrong.
It seems like if you ever talk about your faith out in public, you're ridiculed. And I remember seeing that on TV. Somebody would be, talking about God and their faith, and then somebody would start making fun of them. And it seemed like it was a trend. It's like TV set that for everybody else.
And I think sometimes a bit of it came from fundamentalism, too. Anytime you start forcing people to believe something, when I was in college, it was a non-denomination. I went to a private school, Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. And it's a non-denominational school. It bills itself as a non-denominational school. But it's very clear when you go there that, they are of a Protestant evangelical fundamentalist mentality. And even though Catholics are there, they're marginalized. There's even non-Christians, but they're marginalized as well. And so we would have students that would walk around the campus handing out tracts that would ask questions like, kind of like the Kirk Cameron Way of the Master series, where they go around the streets of Las Vegas saying, you know, do you think you're going to hell? And a lot of people will say, no, I don't think I'm going to hell. And they're like, well, are you a liar? Have you done this? Have you done that? Well, the Bible says you're going to hell for that. So you're going to hell. I mean, that's a terrible form of evangelization. It just drives people off. And I can't wrap my head around why they would even think that that would work, that using scare tactics and then talking to people who think hell is a fiction is even more ridiculous, to try to get them to be afraid of something that they don't even think is real. It's not even logical. But what it has done is tremendous damage, because it makes Christians look like nutcases. In some cases, they are. And it also makes the religion a farce, because it just makes it all the more less believable. And when you have people like that representing it in such a bad way, why would you even want to take a step into that direction? I know it drove me off several times. So all of that is compounding today. And yes, society is having a crisis of morality. It doesn't understand morality because it has no foundation in which to build. You know, the word religion actually comes from the word religio, which is to bind, or religio. I think it's religio, to bind. And what it means is to bring people bring a society together under one system that is accessible to all. That's ultimately the social function of religion. Of course, it has its spiritual component, but there's a lot to be said for that more mundane reaction, and that's been rejected. So this is why you see a culture like we have now in America, where all it is divisiveness. You got the Republicans against the Democrats. You got the conservatives against the liberals. You got the progressives against the extreme. It's just a mess. No one communicates. The reason the government's shut down right now is because nobody wants to freaking talk. And it's sickening. I don't even get into politics. I don't get into political discussion anymore because I'm disgusted by all of it. People ask me, what are you? I'm nothing. Don't even try to draw me into a category, because I don't agree with any of it. I think it all sucks. And it's because all it does is work to divide. And we know from Scripture who the author of that is, because the Holy Spirit binds together. It draws us into unity. And it's satanic effects that drive apart and create division. So, you know, I think America's declared its master. And so now there's a lot of power being given to the demonic through people inadvertently. They don't even realize it. But whether they believe in spirituality or not, whether they believe in religion or not, doesn't matter, because the devil works best when you don't believe in him. He doesn't want you to believe in him. He can exist indefinitely, flying under all of the radars of all of these atheists and agnostics and everybody else that is on the fence, and just, you know, slide under this person as mental illness, slide under this person as, you know, drug addiction. And in many cases, these demonic forces push people into these states. So, you know, a person might not be mentally ill, but after they receive their demonic attachment, the demonic entity starts to create the condition for mental illness as a cover and makes them sick. Same thing with drug addiction. If that's the weakness, you know, demons are like, the very patient, and they'll spend years watching you, looking for your vulnerabilities, and assessing where the best pattern of attack, where they could use it against you. And so, if you have a weakness towards substance abuse, if there's a weakness in yours, and I do believe, you know, substance abuse is largely genetic, then they'll use that, and they create a cover. So that way, when the person acts possessed or oppressed in a demonic way, it can be written off as substance abuse, and the demon can exist indefinitely, and society permits this. So, you know, it's clever. You got to give points where it's deserved, and I mean, certainly the demonic is a very clever, intelligent and I guess you could also say a very formidable adversary. But it's such an easy thing to defeat too. But the one thing that can defeat it, which is the grace of the church, people have rejected.
I don't think people are probably aware about how rampant mental illness is. I work in a hospital, and let me tell you that, you know, there's so many suicidal people, so, you know, psychosis and all this. I mean, it's endemic. It's really surprising.
Mm-hmm.
How much people are messed up out there. And I know, you know, you go to your doctor because you say you're a little depressed and they want to shove antidepressants down your throat and stuff like that. But how do you differentiate between mental illness and somebody that's suffering from demonic oppression? I know I've asked you this before, but for the benefit of the listeners, because, I mean, there's so many sick people out there.
Well, it's a good question, and it does, you know, deserve being repeated as often as possible, because it comes up so often, and it is so paramount to the issue at hand. How does one, you know, how does an exorcist assess the difference? And there's two answers to it, and I've given both answers perhaps in different ways and different times, but there's actually two answers to the question. One, on one level, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter because all of the effects of the demonic are going to come through the psyche initially anyway. So even a person who is genuinely demonically possessed is going to benefit from psychotherapy. There is just the natural physicality of the effect itself that can be treated that way. This is why when we do find an individual who is genuinely oppressed or possessed, that we always encourage psychotherapy alongside the spiritual work that we do. Because the psyche heals best with those methodologies, and the spirit heals best with our methodologies. And both need to be working and active in order to facilitate the healing of the entire person, because we're not just one thing. There's a physical side to us, there's a mental and emotional side, and then there's a spiritual side. And all of those need to be in proper order, working order, in order to overcome be healed from an affliction, because the demonic affliction attacks all of it. But where the difference comes in is the causation. Is the person mentally ill and then picked up a demon along the way because they were vulnerable and easy target? Because, you know, we tend to sometimes see demons as predators. Most of them are actually scavengers. They're looking for picking off the easy roadkill. They're not really concerned about, you know, trying to wear you down. That, you know, there are certain demons that are, you know, that do work on destroying holy people. But for the most part, you know, easy people are what they're really after. And so, you know, if you're mentally ill or have a predisposition towards mental illness, you're going to be a better target than somebody who has a very strong mind, which is why these atheist scientists tend to not have problems with demons, because they have very strong minds and they're just, you know, there's really no threat. And so why go after them? But, you know, the other side of it is sometimes a perfectly healthy person does come into a demonic event, develops an attachment, becomes attacked, and through the course of the effect of that attack starts to develop the effects of mental illness, because it is a certain type of trauma to the psyche. And particularly in the beginning, when nobody knows what's going on, nobody understands what's going on, And typically that's when you start to see very sane people very quickly go the route of suicidal ideation, because that's the ultimate result of a demonic attack, suicidal ideation. I would actually go as far as say, and you know, I think we've talked about this before, my background is in psychology, not religion. My degree is in psychology, not religion. And so I have a very unique perspective on this. And I will go as far as to say that every suicidal ideation has at its root a demonic oppression. Every single one. because I think it would there's no way that a person could justify breaking their own survival instinct, overriding their own survival instinct so easily as to be able to, like, take a gun and shoot their own head off, or, you know, take a lot of pills with alcohol, or jump off a building or a bridge. You know, try to think about doing that. Try to think about what would be required within you to be able to override your natural instinct. I mean, just stand on the edge of a tall building and you're going to start getting that feeling. Whether you're afraid of heights or not, you'll get that butterfly feeling that kind of pushes you back. And yet these individuals can override that sensation and jump anyway. That comes from something much deeper than just simply mental illness. That is an inspiration to defy creation. And that has at its heart the roots of the demonic. So to get to your question, how do you tell the difference? There is always going to be, in a genuine demonic event, externalizations of the demonic. So there's going to be other things other than just the person reacting in a psychotic or delusional way. You're going to get other types of classic paranormal disturbances in that person's environment. Maybe there's scratching on the walls, or, you know, hissing sounds or growling sounds in the dark and nobody knows where they're coming from. Maybe doors are being slammed. You're going to get stenches like, excrement or sulfur burning, sometimes decaying flesh. These are things that will usually accompany a genuine demonic event. So when you're assessing a client and you're trying to say, oh, is this a person with schizophrenia, or is this a person with a demonic oppression or possession, you're also looking at the whole environment. Are other people being affected in the person's home? Are they experiencing things? Is there a long series of negative events that led up to this? And ultimately, do they get better with conventional treatment, or are they getting worse with conventional treatment? Does prayer make it better, or doesn't help at all? Because typically, as soon as prayer is introduced to the equation, if it's a genuine event, there's a reaction. If it's not, then typically you're looking at something that's perhaps more mundane, like a disorder of some kind. So this is all, this is a simplified way of explaining it, but, you know, this is the general formula that one would look for to try to tell the difference.
Yeah, I mean, because I work in a hospital, I mean, you're talking, like, if you look at, like, ER visits, you know, maybe 15% are people that have the suicidal ideation or thoughts or whatever, and it's like, it's really out of control. I mean, there's so many people with issues out there, and it's unfortunate. Yeah. And I would imagine the majority of the people out there are just, especially the doctors, are saying, well, this is just a chemical imbalance, or you just need to see a therapist. But I'm sure in a lot of cases there could be demonic activity and it doesn't even cross anybody's mind.
No, and why would it? Because, you know, that's seen as superstition, particularly in the medical field. You know, honestly, we are very open to working with a client's medical doctors or psychotherapists. In fact, you know, when we see a new client, the first thing we ask for are their medical records. We want to make sure that there is at least a history there, because we'd never want to just jump right in and start performing exorcisms. That would be irresponsible and very unprofessional. And there are those that do this. You know, they'll just take a client's word for it. Oh, wait, you got demons? Oh, let's start praying. You know, that's actually very irresponsible, and it actually can be harmful, because if a person is truly suffering from delusions, then you're only feeding those delusions and making the matters worse. That's never a good thing to do. But if you can talk to the doctors and you can work with the psychotherapists, you know, then you can kind of work and try to figure out, okay, well, I'll work on the spiritual, you work on this side. Let's work together to help this individual the best way that we possibly can. And unfortunately, I would say that only happens in about 10% of cases. Most of the time, they don't even want to talk to me. And because they already have their minds made up as to what kind of person I am. You know, they say, oh, you have an exorcist? They think that, you know, I'm some kind of nutcase out there, you know, walking around with a crucifix.
you need
and
to be
if
healed.
You see me, exactly, you know, and if you see the show, if you see Ghost Adventures, I guess that kind of, you know, you're only seeing the most extreme cases there. These were confirmed cases, you know, and a lot of work went into them behind the scenes. You know, but you're only getting to see the good stuff because you only get 42 minutes to show it. So you're not going to waste time on stuff that's not really interesting. And so it makes me look, you know, it could make me look that way to some people that, oh, look at this guy. He just walks into people's houses and starts exercising them. You know, I mean, that's not the way that it happens. Yeah. Go
ahead, Jason. Sorry.
No, ladies first.
Oh, I noticed lately that there is a trend going towards magic.
Yeah.
Now, you see a lot more about Wicca and things like that. What I can't understand is how somebody can do magic asking a demon to help them do their magic and then not think that there's any kind of coincidences that's going to happen to them later on.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, people dabbling in the occult is a big factor here, a really big one, and it's one we see very often. And, you know, almost in every single case, the victim thinks that they're more special than they are, more important than they are, more powerful than they are, and that, you know, they can handle it. But they can't because obviously, you know, you're coming to me for help. So obviously you're not handling it. And, you know, but they don't want to give up that side of their activity. And not everyone is getting all the way into the, you know, the conjuration of demons. You know, there's certain types of witchcraft and low magic that doesn't involve that kind of thing. But there's risk to all of it. There's consequences to all of it. And to not know those consequences is irresponsible. And unfortunately, where are they learning this stuff? Well, they go to their New Age section of Barnes & Noble, or they go and they buy, you know, a bunch of books from, you know, their New Age bookstore. And, you know, you got these authors that, you know, publishers just interesting selling books that interest people, and writers are just trying to make money because, you know, there's only so much money you can make in this field, and that's one way to do it. So they go and there's nothing that talks about the risks. And in many cases, these books are being written by dabblers themselves because there's no regulation. No one's going in to say, well, let's make sure this person actually is, you know, is a occultist. He has a degree. Well, there's no degree in occultism. So, you know, there's nothing that you can really do to assure that the person that you're reading actually knows anything about it. Sometimes they'll say, oh, well, I'm a third generation witch in my family. It's like, but how do you know? How do you know? I mean, there's no way to really confirm that. So a lot of these books are nonsense, and that just perpetuates nonsense, and it just creates all these armchair experts. And they play around. They think they know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. And then when you try to help them as an expert, then they think you're nuts when you don't give them the answer they want to hear. But it's true. It's every bit true. What you have said there, yes. I don't understand how they can do that and not think there would be consequences. The only answer I can give you from my own experience is that they think that they can handle it better than they can. They think that they're going to, in some way, they're so clever, they're so smart, they're so powerful that they'll be able to outsmart the demon. But they never will.
So I was watching YouTube, and I don't watch a lot of paranormal stuff. I know that's odd. I hardly ever watch anything paranormal. But I stumbled upon these YouTube videos of these Dybbuk boxes and people opening Dybbuk boxes. And you're probably more knowledgeable on that than I am. Can you explain to the audience what a Dybbuk box is and what that represents? And do you feel they're like a legit thing, I know people buy them on eBay, and I'm sure there's a bunch of fake ones and stuff, but I was wondering what your feelings were on that.
Well, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but I'm going to go to the extreme here, which is a rare thing for me. Usually I'm a very moderate thinker, but in this particular case, I'm going to go to the extreme, and I'm going to dare to say publicly that there is only one Dybbuk box, and it's the one that's in Zach Bagans' museum. Every other one is a fake. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible to ritually bind the spirit to a container. You know, it is. And that can be done by an expert occultist. Whether or not it can be done by anybody, you know, you might get lucky. And maybe, you know, one in a million of these boxes would be have an authentically attached spirit. But in most cases, these are people that saw how much money the Dybbuk box went for, and you know that there is a demand for these things because people want, for whatever reason, a spirit in their house, and so you know there's a market, and where there's a market, people will create things and sell it, whether they're true or not. And how, you know, I mean, how can you, again, how can you regulate that? Because I mean, nobody's going to be able to confirm. You know, you're not going to be like, you know, it's not like you buy a product and you open the box and it's not what the product was described to be. I mean, you know, there's a ghost in there. So yeah, I would say most of these, if not all of these that you're seeing on YouTube, are all fakes. Or maybe they're, you know, products of people's delusions, but they're not the real deal. The one that started it all, of course, is the one that Zach Bagans came to own, and now, you know, features at the Haunted Museum, which I actually was there last week and got to see the box. And yes, there is something to it. But a Dybbuk, you know, understand what a Dybbuk is. You know, people think it's like some kind of demon. It's not a demon. It's a spirit of a dead individual, and it's not any different than a negative spirit attachment, which can look, for all intents and purposes, to be demonic, but in reality, what it is, it's a wrathful spirit that has come to become trapped, and then through just no longer having the faculties of logic that and reason that come from the human mind, because, I mean, you know, ghosts don't have a human brain. They lost that when they died, and that begins, you know, rotting away with the rest of the human body. So all they have, really, is there's no cognition, there's no consciousness as we know it. There's just raw awareness, and that raw awareness is experience as instinct. So if your last thought was rage because you were murdered, for example, and the rage you felt towards your murderer becomes what you are in the afterlife. That's what you become. That's what your spirit is a spirit of rage. And then that becomes this, for all intents and purposes, to the living, a demon, because it will act like a demon. It will do the things that demons do. It will wreak havoc. It will make you sick. But the difference is it's not a fallen angel. And so it has to be dealt with differently. And so what that Dybbuk box is that's in the Haunted Museum has a trap spirit, most likely I haven't been able to investigate it, so I can only speculate as to what it is. But what I contended is, from what I know about it, is that it is the spirit of a Holocaust victim that became attached to the woman who created the box, and then was able to attach to the objects that are in the box. And it's now trapped in there. It's looking for release, and it's not being allowed to be released because it's in the box. And, you know, every owner that has had it doesn't want to lose the spirit in there. So this is why it's getting more and more wrathful as time goes on. And think about what captivity would do to any one of us, you know, particularly that kind of captivity. It's kind of a sad thing. And honestly, when I went into the Dybbuk box room, all I felt was sadness from it. I did not feel anything evil. I felt it reaching out to me for help. I really did. So that's what a Dybbuk is. It's basically an angry spirit, but it's a spirit of a deceased individual. It is not a fallen angel or an elemental or something like that.
Okay.
Is it,
well, I'm looking at,
is it fear that keeps people from opening that box?
I think, well, I mean, I think there, I mean, there are those, I mean, it has been opened. And I mean, even a Zach had taken it to a rabbi in one of, on his other show, and the rabbi had opened it. So it's been opened before. Honestly, I think really what it is there's something that is either in the box or the box itself. I think it's actually an object in the box that it's attached to. And that object, whatever that is, needs to be ritually dealt with in order to release the spirit. And once that's done, it's Divic's box no more. It goes back to just being a plain old wine cabinet. And, you know, kind of like a gin, you know, the whole legend of a genie in a bottle. You know, I don't know if you know the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but when they were discovered, a little child, you know, a Bedouin child, found the cave, or with, I guess, throwing rocks around, and he heard something break, and he discovered these ancient scrolls, which became then later known as the Dead Sea Scrolls, in a shattered potter's jar, and he ran out of there in terror, thinking that he released a spirit, because there is a very well known phenomenon in the Middle East that spirits can be trapped in jars, evil spirits or jinn, in the Muslim Arabic tradition. They're called jinn. That's where we get the word genie from. And they would trap them in containers and then leave them in caves or bury them in the desert so that they can't harm people anymore. It was a well-known thing in pre-Islamic Arabia and Persia. Not so much done, I guess, anymore, except again by ceremonial occultists and whatnot. But that's where it comes from. And the Dybbuk box is basically the Jewish version of that, only, you know, not to the extreme.
Oh, that's a very cool history lesson. I did know about the boy, but I didn't know the details behind it. But I'm looking at the clock,
yeah,
and we're just out of time. Now, if anybody wants to contact you and get your help, how would they go about doing that?
The best way to reach me, or to get help from me, rather, is from my office. To just go to nicolaian.org, my website, or esotericcatholic.org. It's not really my website. It's the church's website. Esotericcatholic.org or nicolaian.org, N-I-C-H-O-L-E-A-N. And then just click on the menu where it says request an investigation. You just fill out the intake form, be as complete as possible. You know, there's a large queue. We do work in a triage system, so we do assess individual cases. And it's not first come, first serve. It's most extreme in those that are in most need first. And we're only able to really do a couple cases a month. So, you know, we have hundreds of cases. It's not to discourage anybody from filling out a form, because you never know whether or not we're going to select your case. And sometimes there are people that fill out forms and we reach out to them and they never respond back. So we just move on at that point. So you just never really know if you're going to be picked. So I always encourage everyone, fill out a form and we'll do the best that we can. You can also contact the office by clicking on the contact us link. And there is a spiritual crisis office that's open Monday through Thursday, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. You can call that number, 678-871-6766. And the spiritual crisis counselors will be willing to talk to you about your issue and even help you fill out a form if they feel it would warrant the need of our help. That's the best way. I'm also on Twitter, at Exorcist Bishop. I don't, you know, assess cases on social media, but you can, you know, shout out to me there, follow me there, and I'll be more than happy to answer simple questions.
I'm finding you right now. Thank you.
Awesome.
Well, Brian, thanks for coming back on the show. It's always fantastic, very informational, and we, as always, would love to get you back on in the future. It's a fascinating subject, and yeah, it's just great to get you back on. So thanks for taking the time this evening.
My pleasure. Anytime. I'll always come on this show for you guys.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Take care. God bless everybody.
God bless. Wow, interesting subject. It always makes me nervous talking about the demonic. You know, it's like every time we talk about it, you know, the night when I'm going to sleep, sometimes I have to try and sleep with one eye open.
Well, Brian puts it out really good and simple, and that's wonderful. I really enjoy listening to everything he had to say.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know that we got anything else. I'm not sure what's lined up next week. And I believe you're going to be co-hosting for the rest of the month, right?
I believe so.
Very awesome. So we'll update the Facebook page when we figure out our guests for next week. And unless you have anything else, Maria, I guess we can close her out.
Everybody have a good night. And Jason, keep your head covered up.
Yeah. Good night, everyone. Hope everybody has a safe and productive and wonderful week. And we'll see everybody next week, next Sunday at 8 p.m. West Coast time. And if you haven't already, please give us a like on Facebook at Paranormal Horizons on Facebook. And with that, we'll bid everybody adieu. And you know what I'm going to do right now is I'm actually going to save it for next week. Teaser. Never mind. Disregard.
Okay.
So hope everybody has a great week, and we'll see everybody next Sunday. Good night, everyone.
Good night.